For example, so many people have goals and desires and dreams that they want to accomplish, and they're so focused on the end result. Great. You know, when you get to the top of Everest, there are other mountains to climb. When you get to the top of Kilimanjaro, there's other mountains to climb. When you cross the finish line of Memphis, there are other races to run. Yes, that driver is the goal. But if you're not enjoying the process along the way, you're going to keep going and going and going until you die. You know, you're not finding a deeper reason behind your actions. So you have to have an emotional attachment to that end result, yes, to continue forward, but also enjoy the process of getting there.
I wouldn't call it pride. This isn't straight A's at school or a promotion at work. Admiration feels inadequate. You don't admire someone's resolve. You marvel at it. This is my son, Sean Swarner. The feeling he best gives me is best described as faith. Faith that there's a purpose to every life. All you need to do is have the will to find it and the determination to accomplish your dreams and aspirations. That was your dad talking about you.
Yep. I was going to say ESPN, my dad, on Father's Day.
Wow. I mean, when I saw that piece on you, I think it was published in 2017, and I just watched it this morning. I mean, I got choked up from watching it, and I can only imagine what it must have felt like for you to be covered by ESPN. Remarkable story, and have your dad narrate the overlay of it. Pretty incredible. Yeah, I just wanted to start off with that quote because it hit me so deeply. What comes to mind for you when you hear that?
Yeah, emotions, obviously, like you were saying, it hits you emotionally. But it's interesting because that was part of a full Emmy-nominated film that is on Amazon called True North, the Sean Swarner story. You know, they took a chunk of all this video and combined it down to, I think it was 10 minutes or something, less than 10 minutes.
6 minutes and 53 seconds.
Okay, there you go. So almost 7 minutes. And it was incredibly emotional because, like I said, they aired it on Father's Day, which is really cool. And when they recorded it, he was in the Atlanta studio. I was up in their national studio in Connecticut. And I was actually in, he has no idea. I don't even think to this point, he has no idea. I was in the studio listening in while he was recording. So while it was happening, I'm sitting there getting emotional. I'm wiping away tears thinking this is amazing. And then watching it on, when it went live, I lost it. It was like, this is just unbelievable. The emotions that they put behind it made it into a beautiful piece.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess we should let people know why there's documentaries being made about you and what's going on with your life and what you've done with it, because it really is remarkable. And I'm sure people are curious, why is this guy getting an ESPN documentary made about him? Is he an athlete? Is he an inspirational figure? Yep. So where does the journey begin for you?
I guess to answer your question in one breath, I'm the only person in history to climb Mount Everest, the highest mountain of every continent. I've skied to both the North Pole, the South Pole, and I've completed the World Championship Ironman Triathlon in Hawaii. But I did it all after surviving two terminal cancers, a prognosis of 3 months to live, 14 days to live. I was in a medically induced coma for a year of my life. I was read my last rites, and I only have one functioning lung.
Wow. Incredible. And where does that journey begin?
That's 13. It was my first cancer, diagnosed with advanced stage 4 Hodgkin's lymphoma. And that's when they told my parents, hey, your firstborn son now literally has an expiration date of 3 months. And then it went on to, well, I was in remission from that one, going in for a checkup for the first one. They found a second cancer, completely unrelated to the first one. But if there was anything good about getting the second one, the treatments that they were using to cure the second cancer, if there was any residual from the first one, that medicine was going to be killing off anything maybe floating around my body. And then that's when they gave me 14 days to live as a 16-year-old. And then the coma began because the treatments were so difficult and harsh in my body. And then I was placed in remission, and boom, boom, you know, about 10 years later, climbed Mount Everest with one lung.
And there's so much in that that I must unpack. I mean, as a teenager first, the diagnosis, like, how do you even take that? Are you, how do you even take that?
You know, it's different. And it was difficult because imagine, you know, you're 13, you're in the eighth grade, and you're worried about where you're going to sit at lunch class. You know, what, how you're going to get from class to class, or whatever it might be, you know, whatever you're studying. And while my friends were worried about dating girls, you know, and when you're 13, 14, and maybe even around that time, your hormones are kicking in, right? You're starting to grow hair in very unusual places on your body. You're like, what's going on down there? What's going on under there? I'm losing my hair. I'm on my hands and knees in the shower, pulling chunks of hair out of the drain, literally sobbing my eyes out. And so I think I developed a completely different perspective than most people. I wasn't focused on being popular. I wasn't focused on doing what everybody else was doing. I just wasn't concerned about that stuff. But being diagnosed at that age, to, in all honesty, I don't fully think I understood the ramifications of cancer. The second time, because I went through the first one and I was older, I was 16, 17 years old, I understood a little bit more about what death meant. But at 13, I think it was probably more difficult on my parents than it was on me.
And I read that they said, you know, we wish we could take on this cancer instead of Sean.
Yeah. But how can you do that?
Right.
And you can't switch bodies with someone. You can't give somebody cancer. And you can help mentally, you can help provide that safety net, you can help provide that support, but you can't get in the body and physically fight the cancer.
And so you dealt with this first at 13, 14. Was there a triumphant, like, this is done at after you're 13 or 14 years old?
Yes and no, because when they put me in remission, that's when there's pretty much, it's called NED, no evidence of disease. So I didn't have any cancer cells that were detected, but I still had to go through the treatments just in case anything was left. So in my mind, you know, I'm done. Cancer's gone. But I still have to do those treatments. I still have to vomit. I still have to just be torn apart because the chemotherapy doesn't, it's not a silver bullet. If it destroys rapidly dividing cells, which is why you lose your hair, because it's a rapidly dividing cell, your eyebrows, you know, that sort of stuff. But knowing that I was in remission, still having to go in for the treatments was very, very difficult.
Like, what did your friends say?
You know, it was interesting because I would be in school for maybe a week, 2 weeks tops, and then I would disappear for a month. You know, rumors would abound. I mean, people were saying, oh, Sean's sick. Sean's in the hospital. And worse, yes, some people would say Sean's dead. Like, and obviously, well, you can cure that rumor by showing up. But the rumors, you know, like, hey, guys, I'm not dead. But the rumors would just spread. Like, oh, I heard Sean died today. Like, no, I didn't. I'm still here.
And then, so this happens the first time, then 16, you deal with it again. Was it just like, why me? What was your, how did you get through this?
Great question. Initially, yes, absolutely. Like, what did I do wrong to get it again? You know, I'm very close to the big guy upstairs, right? And my first thought was, you know, God, why? Like you said, I went through the first one. I don't want to go through it again. You know, I know I'm going to lose my friends. I'm going to lose my hair. I'm going to be sick, retching for 36 hours straight. I just, to answer your question, absolutely. Why me? Why me? However, I got to a point where asking that question doesn't change the facts. It's difficult to deal with it. And it's difficult to deal with the situation of having cancer. However, just like anything, you may not be in control of what actually is happening, but you always have control in how you react to it.
What were some of the most useful questions you asked yourself?
I suppose the first question I probably asked myself after why me was, how are we going to get over this? You know, what mindset do I need to have to move forward?
It wasn't until maybe you said 10 years later that you said, okay, I'm going to use this. What was the in-between period of you going to graduate school, you going to college? What was that time like in forming these thoughts? Was it like, I want to create a new identity for myself? Like, how did you think about that period of your life?
I think that was part of it, because I went to college. I grew up in a very small town, right? My backyard was a bean field or a cornfield, depending on the season. And everybody in small towns knows your business. So when I went to college, it was a fresh start. It was a chance for me to go leave the cancer behind. And I didn't really tell anyone. No one really knew. And one of the reasons was, I mean, pretend you're sitting down, you're in a romantic dinner, and it's not dinner conversation. Oh, hey, how's your steak? You know, how's your salad? Oh, babe, well, I had cancer. Like, how do you bring it up? Right? So going through college, I just decided I'm just not going to talk about it. I'm not going to bring it up, because it wasn't a part of who I was in the present moment. However, in grad school is when I was 1,000 miles away. Went born and raised in Ohio, school in Pennsylvania, further my education down in Florida, 1,000 miles away from everybody. And that's when it slowly started creeping back in. And I started I did at one point. I remember I was driving to work. I was a bartender at one of the largest clubs down there. And I remember being at the stoplight, light turns green, and the car in front of me pulls away, and I'm still staring at the space where the license plate was. So I'm just staring at this empty space, and people are honking their horns behind me. And at that, I just didn't care. You know, I didn't get upset. I was just numb. I was like, why am I doing this? And then some other things happened as well that steered me off my moral and ethical path. And those were some things that bounced me back. And that's when I decided, hey, you know, where am I going with my life? Because for years, I didn't know if I had a future. And when you're given 14 days to live, you are terrified to close your eyes every night because you don't know if your eyes are going to open up the next day. Right? So night after night after night after night for years of laying in bed, and either crying yourself to sleep or just falling asleep because you're exhausted from anxiety and fear of death. Then the doctor says, hey, you're in remission. Go live your life. Everything's hunky-dory. Everything's great. Everything's fine. Everything's fantastic. Your family thinks so. The doctors think so. The support system thinks so. But when you're going through a treatment, you have that support. Afterwards, everybody thinks you're okay, and you lose all that support. Now I'm thinking, well, where do I even go? So for the longest time, I had no clue until I was on my own, 1,000 miles away from family, from friends, from everything. And that's when it slowly crept back into my life. And I didn't realize it at first, but I had to deal with what I went through on my terms, not the cancer's terms, but on how I wanted to deal with it.
And what did that look like, you dealing with these thoughts?
Oh, after looking for all the answers in the bottom of the bottle, I kept looking and looking and looking, and there's nothing there. So I dropped that, quit that, went back into athletics. I started climbing in the climbing gyms, hit the gym, started running, started getting myself back to who I originally was, which was an athlete, which was an outdoorsy person. And I loved doing things outside. And it's very, very energizing and healing to be with nature. So putting the phones down, just disconnecting and going and finding who I was. And I literally took the longest look in a mirror and just asked myself those deep questions, like, who are you? Where are you going in life? What do you want? What are your values? Those things that a lot of people are afraid to find the answers.
Why are we afraid to find those answers?
I think a lot of people are afraid to truly understand themselves. Mm-hmm. Because they've strayed so far off their moral and ethical paths. They're like, oh my God, I don't even recognize who I'm looking at in the mirror. You know, because that happened physiologically, that happened to me when I was 60, 70 pounds overweight when I was going through the treatment. I remember looking in the mirror and I really didn't even recognize who I was. I was like, who is this thing looking back at me? But when I was back to being fit again and going back to your question, I think a lot of people are afraid of those answers because they'd probably either let down their family or, more importantly, let themselves down.
And as soon as you ask yourself those questions, you're forced to reconcile with the responsibility of changing your behavior.
Absolutely. And maybe a lot of people don't want to do the work. They don't want to put in the work. They don't want to change things because they're so comfortable where they are right now. You know, but the thing is, if you're comfortable here, then put a little stressor in your lives and then this becomes your new comfort level. And then put some more stressor into your lives and this becomes your new comfort level. But they maybe are terrified to look in the mirror. And I'm just thinking out loud. Maybe they're terrified to look in the mirror because, yes, they're afraid of what they're going to see. But then they are terrified of the steps it's going to take because they're overwhelmed with all the little things they've let into their lives, all the negativity that's bombarded their lives because of all the seemingly mundane decisions they've made in their past to bring them where they are now. And then most people don't want to change.
Yeah, that's really well said. And so you look in the mirror in grad school and What is the first change you make?
Figuring out why I had a panic attack was the first change I had to make.
Wait. Take me through the panic attack. That sounds like a pivotal moment.
It was. In fact, it happened when I was driving to Florida to start my master's. And I remember driving and I had to pull over and get a hotel room, not because I was tired, but because I was literally in my mind freaking out. And I spent the whole night staring at myself in the mirror, just asking me, you know, what the F do you want? What the F do you want? Because I had no clue. And I finished driving. I went to sleep. And at that time, I didn't know how to handle anxiety. I didn't know how to handle a panic attack. You know, but now I understand completely how to do it.
Well, did you figure out that night what you wanted?
No, absolutely not. No, I think it more earlier. I mentioned that a couple other things happened while I was bartending. One of them was I was taking a girl home who had way too much to drink. Right. She ended up passing out in my car, vomiting out the window. And I carried her up some stairs and I was banging on the door. When I was a bartender, all this happened. And I remember banging on the door of the apartment where she told me she lived. It was like 3C. And I had no idea. So I'm holding her in my arms. She's passed out and I'm kicking the door and somebody else answers it. And she's like, again? I'm like, okay, so this has happened before. So I take her inside and drop her off on one of the chairs. And as I was leaving, I saw on the coffee table, you know, the lines of cocaine, heroin needles, burnt spoons, tons of pills. And that's another thing that hit me. Like, what the hell am I doing with my life? You know, I've never done any of that stuff, never will. But on the drive home, that's when it hit me. I started thinking about how did I end up here? Mm-hmm. You know, a moral and ethical teenager, moral and ethical 20-something, mom and dad raised a good guy. You know, a guy from the Midwest. And then all of a sudden, now I'm looking at these drugs and pills and syringes and like, where did Sean Swarner go? So that's one of the things that helped helped me change my life. I dropped out of school, and that's when I decided I had to find a new path in life, back to who I originally was with those values and morals.
You dropped out without knowing the next step?
I dropped out of school. I was working four different jobs, working on my master's and my doctorate degree, which I don't suggest to anyone. It was just too much work. I slept like 3 hours a night. But I did. I dropped out. I took a sabbatical from my studies. You know, sabbatical has now lasted 20-some years. I'm like, I'm not going back. So I did. I dropped out. And that's when I decided I couldn't continue going down that path because I didn't know who I was. You know, I wanted to be a psychologist for cancer patients, but how could I help others if I didn't help myself first?
Wow. And what did your parents say at this time?
Well, they told me it was great. You know, they've always supported me. They've always told me their honest insights and opinions, but they've always supported me. So for example, I'm sure we'll get to it. When I told them I was going to go climb Everest with one lung and be the first cancer survivor to climb the highest mountain in the world, I will never forget hugging my dad goodbye because they lived in Hilton Head, South Carolina. I was going to drive to Estes Park, Colorado to train in the Rocky Mountains. And I will never forget him. As I'm hugging him, he leans over and says in my ear, "We didn't get you through two cancers to go kill yourself in a hunk of rock and ice."
So it was this kind of like support, but also like, we're really scared for you and we're not sure if this is the right plan for you.
Yeah, absolutely. But they would say, hey, if this is what you want to do, go for it.
You must deal with a lot of emotions as a parent, but also as a child, if you really think about your parents' perspective, because you're almost like you have to live with being okay in so many different scenarios. And that's a very difficult thing to think about and to manage. And especially if you're an aware child, you're like, okay, my parents don't want me to do this, but I think it's the best for me. How do I decide? How do you think about that?
You know, it's interesting because I as we said before, I see life a little differently than most people. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to live to be 105 years old and look back and have done nothing in my life. And I don't think anyone should have any regrets. We go through, we're on this giant blue marble in the space once, you know, and we need to see things as opportunities. You know, if you're scared to do something, great, go run towards it. You know, it'll probably be an amazing experience. But so many people who are afraid to try anything new, to step out of their comfort zone, I'm never going to be that person. I want to experience as much as I possibly can because I don't know when my time's up. You know, I went through two cancers, gone on and done some amazing things that no one's ever done before. But at the same time, I could hop in a car and get hit driving to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many people don't understand how fragile life really is, and they take that for granted.
Yeah, making the most of your potential or your life really is giving gratitude to the fact that you're even here at all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the things I do every night is I list off, I actually write down five things I'm grateful for.
Wow. What is it today?
The day's not over yet, but I'm definitely grateful for this, the opportunity to connect with you. I'm grateful for, even though the dog came in earlier, which I'm sure you probably edited out, grateful for the dog coming in here. Yeah, it's a sweet dog. Grateful for the opportunity to put together the apartment that we're working on. I'm grateful for my wife coming in here and helping me get Lilo out of the room. Yeah, the list goes on. But the funny thing is, when you start doing that, because you and I talked about it offline, but I have a program called the Big Heal Challenge, a 3-week mental wellness challenge. And I've had people say for the first week, they had a tremendous difficulty listing off five things that they were grateful for. And it has to be something that happened that day, not your health, your family. Those are given, but something that happened that day. And it's interesting because a lot of people say they had difficulties doing that. because they're not truly present in the moment. They're just kind of on the hamster wheel. They're kind of on cruise control going through. And then when she sat down, one lady in particular, she's like, well, what happened today that I was grateful for? She couldn't come up with anything. But when you practice something, obviously you get better. And when you practice gratitude more and more and more, it literally changes the synaptic connections in your brain through something called neuroplasticity. So once you start utilizing neuroplasticity, change the synaptic connections in your brain, you become more optimistic. You start seeing life from a different perspective, a different angle, and you become more grateful for what you have. As opposed to being a negative person, you slowly turn into a more positive person and have more gratitude for the things you have, as opposed to looking at the things you don't have and wanting more. So you don't come from it. You don't approach life anymore from a state of lack. You approach life from a state of abundance.
Yeah, it's beautiful and so well said. One of the things that I personally have trouble doing is remembering previous versions of myself that weren't grateful or weren't in the, because what you're talking about is common practice, and I've done it so consistently over the last couple of years. But then I think to myself, oh, it wasn't always that way. How connected are you with the previous versions of yourself who didn't think or have this mental state?
You're right. It's difficult in looking back there. And maybe one of the reasons neither of us actually remember that person is because we blocked it out. We don't want to remember that person. Yeah, it's interesting. That's a really interesting question. And to be honest with you, I don't know if I've ever been a negative person. I mean, everyone has negative days, but it doesn't mean you're a negative person. I don't remember the last time I was a negative person. I just don't allow that into my life.
It's a pretty cool feeling of not even remembering the previous version of yourself that acted negatively. I mean, maybe you didn't have one because of the things that have happened to you. When people comment about you, what are the things they say often that surprise you or that you take for granted or just are so baked into your day to day? Like, one thing I can imagine for you would be like gratitude. Like, this guy is clearly grateful for life. And you're like, yeah, that's just who I am. Are there any other traits or ways of being or things that come up for people that surprise them about you?
A couple things take me by surprise. One, you know, because of everything I've accomplished, I take a group up Kilimanjaro, which is right behind me, every year. And I've gone up there 24 times now with 99% success rate. The mountain's average is 48%. So we're double that.
Wow.
And it's because we do things very differently. And a couple people have called me a cyborg. You know, it's like, this guy's not human. But at the same time, other people say, I can't believe how down to earth you are with everything you've accomplished. Like, they say, you remain so humble. And I try to do that, and I might not be, you know, coming across as humble on a podcast because you're supposed to talk about yourself, but for the most part,
I try
to remain humble.
Yeah, you are humble. You do come across as humble, at least. And it's interesting, the dichotomy of cyborg and like a machine, and also this is just a guy who's so down to earth, which is interesting considering all the time you've spent on earth, down close to the ground, and also up to the highest points. I want to go back to your story and go back to, like, you've climbed the highest points in every continent. And you weren't a climber. Like, you didn't have, you weren't raised climbing. Like, that's just like the most absurd thing. So, like, right? Go take us through, like, one, pitching yourself to, like, how did you get this idea to do this, to do the first one?
The first one came up with Mount Everest. for a couple of reasons. One, I figure, you know, get the highest one done. The rest will be downhill. But then I also realized that no cancer survivor had ever climbed Mount Everest. And I wanted to be the first cancer survivor to climb the highest mountain in the world. And I literally wanted to use it. And it was perfect timing because, like I said, I dropped out of school. Sorry, took a sabbatical. Use proper term. I'm never going back. Took a sabbatical from my studies. And then it was perfect timing because I was looking for something else to do. And that's when I did this reflecting on my life and realize, hey, cancer was a part of me, but there's nothing I can do about it except for how I react. How am I going to use what I went through? And my mom volunteered for the American Cancer Society. You know, my dad did a lot of stuff in the community. So I decided I tried to figure out how could I use what I went through to help others. And I wanted to give them hope, which everybody needs. And then after researching, I saw that no cancer survivor had ever climbed Everest. It's like, why not me? Why not for the right reasons? So it started there, and I was living in Jacksonville, Florida. And you're right. I don't know any mountaineers who live in the state of Florida. It's a big sandbar, so I had to move to Colorado.
So you're just like, all right, I gotta. You went with your brother, right?
Yep. My brother and I, at that time, we put everything we both owned in my Honda Civic and drove cross country.
And the thought was, we're going to just climb up as many mountains in Colorado. The thought was, I'm going to grab a coach. The thought was, I'm going to get sponsored. What is the thought process as you're driving to Colorado?
The thought process was, what did I want to do? Mm-hmm. Climb Everest. How am I going to make that happen? Work backwards. So in my mind, I was already on time. But you're right. I had to get sponsors. I had to get the gear. I had to get the training. I had to get everything in place. So the first step from all of that was move to Colorado, find a place to live, go from there. But while we were doing that, you know, we could work on the next step. So when we moved to Colorado, we didn't even have a place to live. So we camped and lived out of the back of my Honda Civic for 2 months. We were homeless for 2 months while we were looking for a corporate sponsorship. You know, and imagine, this was back before the cell phone. So we were using a payphone bank in the library as our office. So imagine you're a large company, right? Like, say you're Gore-Tex or North Face or whatever it might be. I'm like, hey, you know, how's it going? Great. Oh, fantastic. So I have this crazy idea. I've survived cancer twice. I have one lung. I have no climbing experience, and I'm going to climb Mount Everest in 9 months. You want to help? So I'm like, hello?
I mean, that sounds like a pitch that I feel like a lot of people would gravitate towards. What was the responses you were getting?
A very similar response to recently. I had a friend whose son did a school report on me, right? I think, I want to say fourth grade or something like that. And the teacher gave him an F because they said this so-called Sean Swarner, it doesn't exist. What he's accomplished is impossible.
Yeah, that is crazy.
So I called the professor, like, hello? Like, yeah, this is a guy who doesn't exist.
Did he get a new grade?
He got an A. Yeah, he got an A. So
even when it's happened, all this stuff has happened, it's too unbelievable for some people. How does that make you feel?
You know, that's a good question. I never really thought about that. But initially, when I was trying to climb Everest, it made me super upset because people wouldn't take me seriously. Like, well, at the time, they thought it was physiologically impossible to climb Everest with one lung. Like, this is just, you're not going to make it. Like, you cannot pass Camp 3. You can't get past a certain level. But now when people say, yeah, that's, you know, they disbelieve, I tell them, oh, well, you know, hey, grab your phone, Google this guy. And like, oh, wow. Wow. I was like, okay, now go to Amazon, look up True North, the Sean Swarner story. I'm like, wow. I'm like, yeah, like they got great footage and the story's there to empower and inspire people. So it's interesting to see people's, like, to see their eyes change, and you can see their thought process. Like, no, this just isn't possible. Like, all of a sudden, their eyebrows start getting a little bigger, a little higher, a little higher. Their eyes get bigger and bigger, and like, oh, wow, okay.
Why do you think you're not a household name?
That's a great question. I would say, what's sexy about mountaineering? You're on the mountain camping for, it took me a month and a half to climb Everest. You know, I'm guessing you probably haven't gone that long without taking a shower. My ESPN, going back to that, when I finished the seven summits, ESPN was there. My mom told me that when I hugged her, she's like, I could smell you before I saw you. Right? Because I reeked so awful. But then again, if you look at football, if you look at basketball, if you look at, well, American football and soccer, you know, that's fast paced. It's exciting to watch. The only thing exciting that people enjoy out of mountaineering is, oh, hey, this person just fell in an avalanche. Hmm. You know, and that's what people watch NASCAR. You don't watch NASCAR to see the cars go around a track 700 times. You wait for the crashes. You know, people love drama. I've never even seen the Indy 500, so I don't know what it's really like. I don't know if it's exciting. I just picked that as an example. But, and also, if you look at how traditional media is, what they cover and how it's done, keep an eye on the commercials, because they're the ones who are funding what's on television. So a perfect example, I approached two very large corporations before I was climbing Everest, shared with them everything I was going to do. They grabbed another cancer survivor. I never heard back from them. They said, we don't sponsor these things, put together a different expedition, and they tried to do it on their own. And then I came back, and it was literally me against a giant car corporation for media. Who has deep pockets to pay to get on the Today Show, to get on Oprah, to get on, you know, whatever it might be, so other people can see and hear and read about it. And a lot of those people who do have the deep pockets get the sponsorship, they get the money, they pay to get on the PR, you know, they pay for PR to get on the news and to get on the media, to have stories done about them. You're looking at a guy who started right out of grad school, who dropped out of grad school, who had no money, who sold his entire life savings to go climb a mountain, who wasn't a type A personality CEO with millions of dollars to spend. When he came home, I had no house, I had no car, I had no clothes, I had no stocks and bonds. I was broke. I went from climbing Everest to living on couches and couch surfing with friends. So now I'm slowly trying to build back up to where I was before I climbed Everest. And it's difficult to climb up that mountain. It gets easier, but it never gets easy.
Mm. That's so fascinating. How even when you climb the top of one mountain, you're still on the bottom of another. I mean, that's apropos for life. So what, I'm sure that first sponsorship that you got after months and months of calling and the payphones and people rejecting you, what was the first one?
So I looked at the industry a little bit differently. As opposed to going after, say, Marmot or Patagonia or North Face, the actual company, I went to the manufacturers.
Smart.
Who actually make the Gore-Tex. The Gore-Tex was the first one. They have a material, patented material that goes in all of those. So now what I did was I just got a big backer who had the connections to all those other companies who could do the introduction.
That's really smart. And what was the feeling like when you got that first?
Yeah, I guess I didn't answer your question. The feeling, it was overwhelming. I mean, it was the first step of obviously many, but it was a tremendous step. And the feeling was excitement that I hadn't had in a long time. And it gave me hope. You know, it gave me hope that, hey, this is going to happen.
Yeah, I feel
because,
it in your voice.
Yeah, because it wasn't just myself, my family, my brother, and I believing what I was doing. It was other people outside of my close network, you know, who had a vested interest in my success.
It gave them something to support you as well. Like, oh, this isn't just a pipe dream that Sean has. This is real. This is going to happen.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they took a chance on me. And I think from that, it just expanded to other companies and more opportunities.
And it's fascinating too, that you, like, I felt in your voice when you said it gave me hope. It really, it was moving in your voice. And it's funny because you brought up a flag that said hope. I don't know. Did you do that for everyone? Did you do that more recently? Like, what's the origin of the hope flag?
The origin of the hope flag stemmed from an idea that my mom and I came up with, and actually my whole family came up with, to utilize what I was doing as a fundraiser for a cancer charity. People could put names on a flag that I was taking to the top of Mount Everest. And for, I think it was $25 to put a name on the flag. And that became a fundraiser. So the entire time I was climbing up and down the mountain, I had that flag folded up in my chest, close to my heart, as a constant reminder of my goals. And then after climbing Everest, we decided, okay, we want to do the same thing on the highest mountain on every continent. The flag kept getting bigger and bigger, more names and more names. And then the ultimate culmination was for what's called the Explorer's Grand Slam, which is the seven summits in the North and South Poles. My finishing point was the North Pole, and I literally had a flag that was probably 6.5, 7 feet wide by 4 feet tall, and it said hope on there as well. Thousands and thousands of names touched by people, of people touched by cancer, and not just names, people. Yeah, that's the big thing. And those were the driving forces behind the expeditions, hands down.
And on the top of the hope flag, it says water, sky, air, earth, fire. And on the bottom, it says prosperity, peace, health, wisdom, and compassion. How do you come up with the top and bottom of those, of the flag?
So those actually, if you look at, and I'm sure you've seen prayer flags, you know, 5 different colors. So let's just say they're Nepalese or Tibetan prayer flags that the Sherpas use. And they hang them at base camp. They string them from a pole in the middle, basically. And they're blessed by a lama, which would be the, let's say, the equivalent of a bishop in Catholicism, right? So the lama blesses these flags, and they span over base camp. And they, like I said, they're 5 different colors, represent 5 different elements of the universe. And they have mantras on there. And they're made of silk, and they flap in the wind, and they believe that each little strand, when it gets patted off, is a prayer floating to heaven, or, you know, a prayer going around the world. So what you just read off, those also represent the 5 different colors of the flag, which go back to symbolize the 5 different colors of the prayer flags.
That's beautiful. And then those are available for ordering, right? You can order a hope flag.
You can get a little one, yeah.
That's really cool. I'm definitely going to get one after this. And I, on that idea, like, what is your relationship with faith like and with God?
Interesting question. How much time do we have?
We could go all day, baby. I mean, this is the most fascinating area for me personally. And I would love to hear. I'm so curious.
My faith and my religion is, I wouldn't say it's your typical Christian, but I do believe in God. But I've also been to 70 different countries. So I've studied, I've seen Hinduism, I've seen Buddhism, I've studied Buddhism, which actually isn't a religion. It's just, it's a way of life. A lot of people confuse it. They're like, oh, Buddhist religion. No, it's not a religion. And I think, I don't want to put anyone down, but if anyone thinks that, you know, because the Bible says the earth has been here for 7,000 years, I also believe in science, you know, full on. But I also think that science and religion can live hand in hand. So let's just hypothetically say that the Bible says, you know, God made the earth in 6 days and he rested on the seventh. Yeah. How do we know that one day wasn't a billion years? You know, I don't know that. I didn't write the Bible. You know, so maybe that's what it is. Maybe in my perspective, when God created man out of his image, it wasn't the human being, it was energy.
I've never heard that perspective before. That's amazing, though. Continue.
And I think, well, think about, because we know the Big Bang happened, you know, I'm still thinking that's God. God's energy. A lot of people believe that there are different forces around the universe, dark matter, things like that, energy that we can't see. You know, the Bible says that God is everywhere. Energy is also everywhere. So I think that the Bible and all these religions have so much more in common than they do in differences. And I have always believed that God is a source of energy.
Something in my body just lit up. So like I use that as a signal for like, oh, there's some truth or wisdom there. Wow. When did you come to that realization?
I think it's always been there, but I also think that in our subconscious is where, like, for example, when people pray for God to do something for them, in essence, you're praying for the strength for yourself to do it, because God's not going to do it for you. You know, he's not going to give you five magic numbers to win $1 billion, right? And then the magic Powerball number. That's just not going to happen. He doesn't care about that. So when people are grateful for things, I do believe that you're thanking God for this, that, the other thing. But again, like I said, it goes back to energy. But I also believe it's getting into your subconscious. And I think that's also where God lives, because everybody, if you look at evolution, because of technology, we've lost that sixth sense and that gut feeling. Like, how many times have you done something, your gut told you not to do it, don't do it, don't do it, and it comes back to bite you in the butt? You realize, I shouldn't have done that. Well, there are key factors all over the place if you just open your eyes and pay attention to them. That's God telling you certain things because of the energy that he provides in our subconscious, and our subconscious is that little voice in the back of your mind chirping away. So, like I said, we could go on and on forever, but this has just been a concept I've been developing my entire life, because, you know, also, what's the Newton's first law? You know, matter cannot be created nor destroyed, right? So how can all these people be getting into heaven without it overflowing?
What do you mean by that?
Well, like with the souls, right? When people die, they go to heaven. More people are being created. More people are dying. So where's that coming from? Where are they going? So again, I think it goes back to being energy, and energy can be put, placed, transferred, whatever.
And what happens when we die?
That's a great question that no one knows the answers to. As soon as I figure that out or come to a conclusion, I'll let you know. We'll have another discussion, because I don't know. I mean, maybe reincarnation, maybe an opportunity to be part of the cosmos. You know, but depending on the type of energy you have in you, good, bad, in the middle, confused, whatever, it's kind of goes on from there. But I don't know. My grandpa passed away when he was 95. My grandma just turned 101, and I asked her, and she's like, I don't know either. Because I think if you dig deep enough, no matter the Pope, for example, he still doesn't know. No one knows. Factually, no one knows what happens when you die. You know, and if he's so, it's just kind of like a joke, like aside, but if he is so convinced that when he dies, he goes to heaven, why is he riding a bulletproof car?
It really is remarkable, right? Like, we're just placed here with this consciousness. You get dropped on this floating rock. You don't know why you're here. You don't have any idea of like what happened before this, if anything. You don't remember anything before. And yet, it's like the deeper and deeper I go into nothingness, the deeper and deeper I believe that it's like we were put here. And I tell myself the story of like, we were put here with this purpose, with this reason for being, which may or may not be true. And I feel like when I'm done with this incarnation, I'll go to another. Maybe it's just a story I tell myself that makes me feel better and allows me to sleep at night. But yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating.
Absolutely. It really is. And you can ask yourself those questions over and over and over again, and you'll never know. So let's make a promise here. If you go before I do, come back and let me know what's on the other side. If I go before you, I'll try to make it back and come back from the other side.
I'm reading, I'm trying to see if I can find it, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying right now.
Okay.
And they talk about how masters will go from one incarnation to the next, and they'll leave clues in little children to let them know where they're coming. And I'm like, this is amazing. Like, I want to believe this story is true, you know, and I'm really enjoying that book. So maybe there's some answers there and people have studied it. One thing that the book talks about is like how you treat death. Like your whole life, you're preparing for the moment of you dying. And an interesting question to ask might be like, how are we preparing for that final moment?
That I think that goes back to what legacy do you want to leave behind? Mm. You know, because of everything I've been through, my wife and I can't have kids. But every time I climb the mountain, she's supported 100 orphans in Africa at the foot of Kilimanjaro every year with food.
Wow.
So technically, I guess we have 100 kids. And we're working on, you know, supporting more and more every year. That's a great question. How it's, I don't want to say it's the ultimate goal, but it's the ultimate end place. It's the ultimate destination. And so many people are focused on reaching that goal, but this is one goal, one end place, I guess, one, not necessarily destination, but just the ultimate end of reaching a goal that no one wants to get. No one's in a hurry to get there. So I guess how I'm preparing for death is by living. Mm.
It's beautiful. You're living life to the fullest. You really are. And that's how you can prepare best for death, it seems to me, from my vantage point. You've been involved in some crazy moments, but the fact that you were in New York City when the Twin Towers came down is so remarkable to me. What happened there?
Well, I was going to the bathroom when someone knocked on the hotel door and said the United States has been bombed. That's literally how it happened. And I was like, wait, what? And my brother answered the door and he was there with me. And this was before climbing Everest. And I was there to submit a proposal to Johnny Walker, where their whole concept is keep walking. And they wanted to be a potential donor for or backer for Everest. And I remember when that happened, it was the quietest New York City's ever been. I've been in New York a bunch of times, enough times that people ask me for directions now. And I actually know how to give them directions of where they're going. But it was so quiet. We tried to donate blood. We went over here. They're like, we have enough blood. It was the eeriest feeling ever. You know, looking up at where the Twin Towers were, it was just this plume of smoke.
Wow.
And I remember trying to call mom, trying to call dad, and we could never get through. You know, the phone lines were jammed. Like, you know, our call couldn't be completed.
And how long did you stay in New York at that time?
The day after it happened, Johnny Walker chartered a bus and moved all of us. There are a handful, I think maybe 20 people who are pitching different ideas. They chartered us to Philadelphia. Wow. They put us in a hotel for a couple of days, and we were on one of the first flights out. You know, some people lived in California. They were in New York. They rented cars because no one was flying. You know, there was a complete hold on flights anywhere around the world, I think. But we were on one of the first ones going out, and I remember the TSA line was wrapped around the building, like out front of the building, down the road. There were people dressed in military uniforms with their rifles right in hand. I mean, it was terrifying.
Wow. And it must have, like, one thing that I remember my uncle telling me is that, like, when that happened, it was like there was an assumption baked into it that this would happen more, right? Like, this wasn't the last one. What, did you feel that way?
Maybe because it was the first real demonstration that the United States of America was vulnerable. And we could be attacked on our own soil.
Yeah.
So maybe it showed that we had weaknesses and we had open spots.
Yeah. And what did you, how did this, like, change your plans, if at all?
We were still focused on getting to Kathmandu, still focused on getting to Nepal to climb Everest, but the funding didn't come through as much as we had hoped, because Johnny Walker, as opposed to giving a lump sum to a winner, it's actually kind of cool. They divided it up and gave it to about 10 people.
It wasn't as much as you expected. Because you expected to win because of your crazy story.
Correct. So we went in there with full intentions on winning, you know, let's say 75 grand. You know, full intentions of winning 75 grand and getting the backing to climb Everest, but it didn't happen. So we had to scramble, and that's when we sold everything to make it happen.
And what was the training like as you're getting funding? How did you manage that?
The training, I tried to do something every day. You know, because understanding and knowing that consistency is more important than intensity, going out there and being consistent in my training, building myself up slowly, slowly, slowly. I would be out in the mountains in Colorado during a snowstorm in shorts and a t-shirt to get used to the cold weather, snowballs in my hands. Snowballs in my hands just to get used to the cold. I figured that a bad weather day on Long's Peak, which is the highest mountain in Colorado, north of I-70 up in Estes Park. A bad day on Long's Peak was better than a good day in the Himalayas.
So it was good training ground.
Absolutely. But the only thing was, I didn't, because of 9/11, I couldn't have the experience on a different mountain to get the high altitude experience. So when we got to base camp, the highest, which is at 17,600 feet, the highest mountain I had ever climbed was Elbert in Colorado, just roughly rounded up and say 14,500 feet. So when I got to base camp at 17,600 feet, that was 3,000 feet higher than I had ever been training.
Wow.
And I still had another 12,000 feet to go.
Were you scared that you were going to die?
There was only one point when I was really getting anxious, and it was going up the summit push. And when you're up at extreme altitude, two severe things can happen to your body because of the less atmospheric pressure outside. It could be high altitude pulmonary edema or high altitude cerebral edema. And cerebral edema is essentially altitude-induced swelling of the brain, and the only cure is to go down, right? So it's wonderful. And then the other one is pulmonary edema, where your body starts leaking fluid. The fluid collects in your lungs, and you essentially drown on your own fluids. Another wonderful way to go. So we were up at Camp 3, my Sherpa friends and myself. We were at Camp 3 at about 23,000 feet. And I remember having we call them freeze-dried nasties, but it was a freeze-dried meal of beef stew. So like the spiral noodles, the cubed carrots, the green peas, and the chunks of beef. So I chowed that down at about 6:30 p.m. And then I went to sleep, tossed and turned because no one sleeps well in altitude. And then the next morning, roughly 11-12 hours later, I had this overwhelming, horrible sensation to get everything I ate out. Though it was still in my stomach. I remember vomiting and I could still see the spiral noodles, the cubed carrots, the green peas, and the chunks of beef. My stomach didn't digest anything. So my body was essentially shutting down. And we were supposed to leave from Camp 3 to go up to Camp 4 and then go on for the summit later that evening. But I couldn't physiologically, I couldn't move from there because my body had pretty much shut down. And the only cure is to go down in altitude. So I slept on oxygen that night. The next day, I slept on oxygen, woke up after that and went up. But the ironic thing is, when we were scheduled to go from here, from Camp 3 up to Camp 4 and then shoot for the summit, that's when I got sick. Every other group was on the same schedule as us to go because there was supposed to be a weather window. When they left Camp 3, they got to Camp 4. I'm still down at Camp 3 because I'm sick. They left that evening to go on for the summit. The weather turned bad and they all had to retreat off the mountain because you get one shot. Wow. So if I wouldn't have been sick, I would have gone up with that same group and gone up for the summit and not made it. So it was a blessing in disguise.
Wow. What makes you say you wouldn't have made it?
Because the weather turned bad. So everyone who left when I was supposed to, they arrived at Camp 4 and they left that evening for the summit. That's when the weather turned bad. And everybody who was on the other expeditions, they actually retreated off the mountain. They bailed on the summit push and they came back to Camp 4 and then went off the mountain because you get one shot with the amount of oxygen canisters you have. So if I would have been on that same schedule as them, and if I wouldn't have been sick, I would have gone up the day before for the summit. But it turned out to work out perfectly.
And what was that feeling like when you actually hit the summit?
If you could take every emotion you've ever had and wrap it into like a tiny little ball and explode it all at once, that's what it was like.
Oh my God.
You know, I got up there. I was elated. I was super happy. I was super excited. And then I was super sad because I started thinking about all the people touched by cancer and the reason I was on the mountain. Then I started thinking about, hey, I got to get this flag up to the top, wrap it around the top. You know, so I went through the whole gamut of emotions, to be honest.
And then what'd you do when it was over?
I got back home as quickly as possible. I wanted to get back to Kathmandu. I wanted to relax. I lost roughly 30 pounds on the mountain. So I'm about 6'2". I weighed about 180, 185 pounds going over. I weighed about 150 coming home. I was just emaciated. Just because at that altitude, you need about 12,000 calories a day just to maintain your weight.
Oh my God.
Right, so there are no fast food joints up there. You cannot get it in. Right? It just doesn't happen. So I got home. I remember going back up Long's Peak, which was one of the peaks that I trained on. It's 14 miles round trip, 14,256 feet. And normally going from the trailhead to this section called the Keyhole would take about 4 or 5 hours. I got there in about 45 minutes. Because my body was adjusted to the altitude. I was used to 20-some thousand feet. And I was up there in my tennis shoes, and it was all ice covered in the back. And I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to do that because I didn't just go climb Everest to die in the Rocky Mountains.
And how soon did you say, all right, I got to do another one?
You know what? I think the longer, when you do something extraordinary, when you do something that requires a massive amount of effort. The further away you get from that, the more you forget the bad parts. Right. So then I started thinking, oh, well, I forgot about the fact that I was miserable and cold. I forgot about the fact that I was sleeping on the ground, you know, in a tent, not showering, you know, all those things. The further away I got from there, the more and more I felt like I missed it and I had to get back. So I went up Kilimanjaro a year and a half later, I think, and then Elbrus a week and a half after climbing Kilimanjaro. So I would say about a year went by, but I knew I had my eyes set on the seventh summit.
Wow. And then you completed the seven summits. And what was that feeling like?
That one was, I completed the seven summits on Denali, the highest mountain in North America, up in Alaska. That was the seventh. And it was the coldest mountain on earth. It took me three attempts. I fell 100 feet the first time. We got more snow. Yeah. So I was going up the crux of the climb, which is like an 800 meter bulletproof ice sheet. And I had my climbing partner here. We had 50 feet of rope between the two of us. So I went up and I misstepped on a new crampon. I was testing out. Crampons are the spikes you attach to the bottom of your boots. So we had 50 feet between him and I. And I was just about ready to set there and belay him in. But because we had that 50 feet, I misstepped. I fell 100 feet and then I fell 50 feet to him and then another 50 feet below him. And it was so weird because in different perspectives, you have a different idea of time, right? So for him, it was like, it was over like that. But for me, I remember I was rocketing down this glacier and calmly I'm telling myself, well, this isn't good. Like, I should probably do something. So I rolled over, used my ice axe and came to a stop. But then when he, and I climbed back up to where I initially fell. And then when he came up to where I was, my adrenaline was gone. I was freaking out. I was like, okay, man, we have to get back to camp. I'm done. And then again, I'm a huge believer in signs. So sitting in the tent down below, it's like, you know, give me a sign. Let me know if it's my time to be here or not. And I leaned back in my tent. My hood caught my glacier glasses that were hanging out, snapped them right in the nose. And I kind of needed those to get down. Like, I got your point, but I'm going down. Like, I need those. So pulled out the backups, went home. Next, the year after, I remember sitting there. We were at 11,000 feet. So let's base one, two, three, like camp three out of five. And I remember one night I woke up because I was sweating. And when it's really cold, snow becomes an insulator. I'm sleeping in a sleeping bag that's rated to 40 below zero. I unzip it. I flop it open because I'm sweating. And I roll over and my tent is literally right on my nose. And I poke it and I can feel the snow. So I went to the front of the tent, got my shovel. I had to dig out and up because we got more snow in 2 days than the Alaska Range did that entire winter.
Oh my God.
So I remember we went up and I used my avalanche probe, which is like it comes in segments, right? So you can fold it up and carry it. It's about this big normally, but you can extend it out to be 12 feet long, right? So I was using that with the PJs, which are the rangers up in the mountain who do the rescue. And we were going up with those guys and we were using the avalanche probes to find other tents in the area. So we dug out our campsite, right, from all the snow. And then we dug a trail, essentially a path to the next one that we found, dug them out, and then did the same thing. So we're using our avalanche probes to find the tents. And then we were digging from tent to tent, basically. And if you could take an aerial picture of it, it'd kind of be like the cross section of an ant farm.
Oh my God.
So then because of all that snow, our avalanche hazard was off the charts. We flew home. Randomly, I got sponsorship from Frontier calls me up and they're like, hey, we want to send you back up the mountain. I'm like, okay, that's great. I don't have a team. So then I somehow got connected to a group from Vail, Colorado. I was still in Colorado, who they were going up to climb Denali. But a week prior to that, they had one of their teammates who was at a railroad crossing, got into a bike accident, broke her nose. She couldn't go. So they're looking for somebody else. And I went out and climbed an ollie with people I never met before.
Oh my God. And that time you reached the summit.
It was perfect weather. It was a perfect schedule, perfect weather. We were on the summit. It was like a slight breeze. And I also remember being up there. Again, I collapsed to my knees just in tears. I pulled out another flag from my chest. It was always close to my heart. You know, pulled that flag out, wrapped it around. Actually, I dug it in the snow. So I dug a hole in the snow with my ice axe and buried that. I just put my hands in my face and I lost it. And what was really cool, somehow, I still don't know how this happened, but somehow when Frontier was flying my parents up there to Denali, up to Anchorage, Alaska, I have no clue how they found this out, but the pilots found out that I summited. The pilots got in touch with the flight attendants. Flight attendants came up with a bottle of champagne to my mom and dad, who woke them up and said, "Your son's on the top of Denali right now."
Wow. How do they know that?
I don't know. But somehow through like the chain of command, like somebody radioed down, the PJs maybe got in touch with somebody else in the government. The government got in touch with the FAA. The FAA got in touch. I have no clue, man.
That's, to me, that's God. That's incredible. You know, dude, it's like some people are so incredible at being human, and you've been able to transform your pain. And the crazy thing is about this, like you talk about those first two like missed attempts, call them. Like I just ran my first marathon this past weekend. And
nice.
Like the level of pain you experience that I could just say in like one sentence of like, yeah, like at mile 24, I thought it was like, I couldn't continue going, but I did. I found a way. It's like, that's one sentence or one paragraph. And what it feels like in the moment is like days. And it's really, I can only imagine what that must have been like when you're fighting the natural elements. And it's remarkable to talk to you.
Well, I was gonna say thanks, but congratulations on your marathon, man. That's not anything to laugh at. Right? Those are difficult to do because it's not only just finishing it, but the training that goes involved that's involved in it, the training behind the scenes, and all the stuff that people don't understand goes into it. The fuel, the mindset, the training, the body. That, you know, there's so many things, so many aspects that go into it. So congratulations. Which one was it?
I did St. Jude's in Memphis, Tennessee.
Ah, nice.
Yeah, it was wonderful. But you know, you obviously have done endurance events. You did the Hawaii Ironman, and that's incredible. The fact that you got through that, like you said, okay, summiting to all these peaks was not enough. You just needed to do the Ironman as well.
Nice. I wanted to do the Ironman because I remember laying in the hospital bed and watching it on TV.
Wow.
When I was battling one of the cancers, and I told myself if I got better, I was going to finish that race.
Wow.
So I did. Yeah. You know, the opportunity came up and they actually called me to be a media spot. I didn't qualify. So let's get that out there. Let's put that out there right now. I didn't qualify for it. I got a media spot. And I had to do a half Ironman to let them know that I could at least finish that. And then the full Ironman, which is roughly 2.5 mile swim, 112 mile bike ride, and you finish with a marathon. So it's an interesting set of tools, but in all honesty, anybody can do it. Anyone can do what I've done. Just you have to put in the time, you have to have the right mindset, you have to have the right warm clothes to make it happen. But anyone's capable of doing so much more. It's the mind that gets in the way. The body's designed to do amazing things.
Yeah. I mean, someone asked you about the role of visualization in making up the mountains. And you said, "I fully believe in the mind-body connection. I think that the mind gives up long before the body ever would. Every night I went to bed and visualized myself reaching the summit, and I attached all of my feelings to that. If you don't have an emotional attachment to something, then what's to drive you when things get tough? If you don't believe something is possible, then it's not. On the mountain, things got hard, but I just kept moving forward. That applies to any mountain you're fighting in life, not just a physical one and not just an Ironman as well.
Absolutely. I mean, so many people, for example, so many people have goals and desires and dreams that they want to accomplish, and they're so focused on the end result. Great. You know, when you get to the top of Everest, there are other mountains to climb. When you get to the top of Kilimanjaro, there's other mountains to climb. When you cross the finish line in Memphis, there are other races to run. Yes, that driver is the goal. But if you're not enjoying the process along the way, you're going to keep going and going and going until you die. You know, you're not finding a deeper reason behind your actions. So you have to have an emotional attachment to that end result, yes, to continue forward, but also enjoy the process of getting there. That's what people oftentimes forget about, because when you get to that mountaintop, you know, great, then what? You still have to come back down. You're only halfway.
Yeah, that's really well said. And it's so interesting how my podcast logo is a mountain, and, you know, just sitting across from you, I've never climbed any mountain before, but not at least in the physical realm. But just to hear someone who's really done it at all the continents is really cool. And I'm really inspired by your journey and you and everything you stand for. So thank you for being you, man.
I appreciate that, Danny. You know, that means a lot. And if you're not busy the second or third week in July and you have an interest in actually climbing a physical mountain, that's when we're heading back to Kilimanjaro.
What's the date on that?
I'll just plant that seed.
Well, my birthday's in the second or third week of July, so.
Well, because I've taken people from, you know, 13 to 70 years old up there. There's nothing technical about it. It's just a high altitude hike. And a lot of people think, oh, it's no problem hiking up there. Like, yeah, 19,000 feet, you're sucking wind. It's super difficult.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
When's your birthday?
July 13th.
That might work out perfectly. Just saying.
Oh, man. Well, we'll think on that. We'll meditate on that and see what comes up. I appreciate you so much. I like to end these podcasts with a challenge for people, or ask the guests for a challenge to help live a better life. We've shared so much over the past hour and 15 minutes, and I'm so grateful for it all. But does a challenge come to mind to leave someone with to take on in the next thing that they're doing in their day to day?
I would say the challenge would be go to thebighillchallenge.com. Okay. You know, it's a 3-week mental wellness challenge I put together that helps people utilize their personal core values to get more out of life. And it's essentially, what if you could discover your innermost motivators so that you could accomplish your outermost desires and goals?
That's linked down below. Anywhere else we should send people to connect with you further?
Yeah, SeanSwanner.com. And these are the easy questions. I can answer these all day long. These are the easiest questions you've asked me so far.
Kind of different than what happens after we die.
Right. A little bit.
Yeah. Sean, All your links are down below in the description. I'm so grateful for you. You're an inspiration. You're an amazing human being. I feel your warmth from across the screen, and I'm excited to just continue following your journey and watch you become a household name, because my guess is in this lifetime or one lifetime, people will know the name Sean Swarner, because you really are an inspiration. Thank you for being you, man.
I appreciate that, Danny. I'm grateful for you as well. And I definitely appreciate the opportunity to connect, not only to share my story, but to connect like this. So thank you.
My pleasure.